Hi, everybody. This is Steve Savitsky. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today I have Rabbi Aaron Rakevet Rothkopf, who everyone knows. I don't even have to introduce him. And we're going to have a nice dialogue about a beautiful article he wrote. Rabbi Rakevet, how are you today?
Baruch Hashem, we are well, and we are celebrating the reissuing of a fourth revised edition of both my first two books about Rabbi Rebel and about Rabbi Silva.
Wow, fantastic, unbelievable. Well, listen, everybody knows you, and you've spoken all over the country, all over the world, and, of course, the work you've done on the Rav. And you wrote a very interesting article for the Jewish Action where we really commemorate the 20th yahrzeit of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and you've enlightened us about the fact that there was a really special relationship between the Rav and Lubavitcher Rebbe, and I'm sure not very many people know that, right?
Well, it was not only an ongoing relationship ever since they met in Berlin, but the story I tell at the beginning and what happened afterwards, I think, says it all. Namely, I was sitting with the Rav in his room when Lo Aleinu, he was sitting shiva for his mother. It was quite early in the morning. I had come early because I was a Rebbe in the YU at the time, and I had to give shiur later. And there was no one else with us. There was a knock on the door, and I went to open the door. Two patriarchal figures came in, Rabbis Gordon and Jacobson, who were very close to the sixth Rebbe and afterwards to the seventh Rebbe. And I saw the Rebbe's face light up, and they said, "We are here representing the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Lenachem Avil," because by that time the Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, did not leave the 770 Eastern Parkway. But, and they then got involved in the whole discussion about life in Haslavich and Lubavitch and the old home, etc. But when they left, Rebbe turned to me, meaning my Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, and he said to me, and that's what I quote in the article, the gist of it being that both he and the Rebbe were students in the University of Berlin. No one knew where he was coming from. He evidently, and we see from pictures, looked like every other student at the university at that time. But everyone knew who the Rebbe was even at that time, with his Hasidish dress, demeanor, and deportment.
Right. You mentioned that, saying that everyone else really kind of dressed as college students or graduate students, whereas the Lubavitcher Rebbe dressed the way he normally did, right?
Right, and I cite sources afterwards where the Rav told, I believe it was the rabbi from the Young Israel who drove him, Rabbi Kowalski from
Israel. Right.
And he told him that one time the younger Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson came to see him, and the Rav offered him something to drink, and he noticed he wouldn't drink, and finally the Rebbe broke down and told him he was fasting evidently Monday and Thursdays in Berlin. And in addition, he revealed that he had the key to the mikveh. So as you know, Hasidim go to mikveh every day, or at least many Hasidim, because of Takanat Ezra, which they still observe. And here the Rebbe would go from the university to the mikveh. So there certainly was a deep respect for the Rebbe. And of course, it went the other way as well. Namely, and you see the sources I bring, that when the sixth Rebbe, the father-in-law of the seventh, visited his son-in-law, he was introduced to the Rav, and they became extremely, I would say it was a mutual admiration society, which impacts, as I show, upon the history of Yeshiva University afterwards.
Right, that he was actually instrumental in getting the job. But the thing I want to understand is that, why do you think that the Rav and the Rebbe Lubavitcher Rebbe never had even a more direct contact? You mentioned in the article, in the ensuing decades, the Rav and the Rebbe maintained an indirect but ongoing relationship. Is that the nature of who they were, or why wasn't it closer?
Well, one winds up, the Rav Mori Rebbe winds up in Boston. The Rebbe, of course, winds up in Brooklyn. They're functioning within two different worlds. Namely, as you and I both know very well, the Rav, in its essential gestalt, essential core, remained a Litvak. The Rebbe, of course, was involved, and which means, you know, his main achievement, or the apex of his achievement, was in the little classroom in room 102 in Yeshiva University, giving shiur. In my time, it was no more than 35, 40 students, and that was his life, the shiur. The Rebbe, of course, reaches out to hundreds, then thousands, ultimately tens of thousands. We can even say hundreds of thousands. But that's a Hasidic Rebbe with a Fabrengen, with all that went with it at a very early time already. You talk about websites today and whyutorah.org. But think of the Rebbe where they had the phone connections going all over the world. Then they used cable TV.
Right.
So there's a basic difference in gestalt. See, I would say, and this is my erudite conclusion after knowing Zverev and so many years of research and speaking with very intimate family members of the Soloveitchik family, he had a much more direct relationship with Rav Aaron Cutler. See, that was a relationship in learning, in Litvish. Mm-hmm. With the Rebbe, I would say it was more indirect. They exchanged letters, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Lower Leinu, when once at Shiva they went to visit. But on the other hand, there was certainly great admiration, and that is that interview I quote with the Mariv, which you
right,
shall
right. 1977,
right? Which is very, very powerful, where the Rav speaks with great admiration of the Lubavitch reaching out. I think his description of asking someone to put on tefillin, you have to remember, we studied with by Litvish Rabbanim. I don't believe Rav Yeruchim Gerelik was thrilled, or Rav Noach Bornstein was thrilled with asking someone on a street corner, are you Jewish, did you put on tefillin today? It was a different attitude. But Rav said, and this is brisk genius, he said, when you ask someone to put on tefillin, you're asking him to think about his Jewish roots. And when someone starts to think, you have no, when a Jew starts to think, you have no idea where it may end. And I think the Rav has a very insightful part there.
Right. I'm saying most people, I would imagine, would think, knowing the Rav, that, you know, he would look at this, you know, Chabad, you know, Chabad people putting, you know, asking people to put on their tefillin, that, you know, it was something he would not really be supportive. He wasn't that. He certainly would never do it.
Right.
But yet,
right.
Yet on the other hand, he admired it.
Right. Right. And he gives Chabad the credit. We all knew when we grew up, I'm a little older than you are, but I remember the New York Times. I write about this, by the way, in the Suvi era, their attitude towards Orthodox Jews, a sickly weed transplanted from Europe. So whenever the New York Times, which then was the heart of the American newspapers, this is the golden touch, the golden standard, they would never interview an Orthodox rabbi. To
right.
them, Judaism was a reform rabbi, maybe a conservative rabbi. And the Rav speaks so beautifully how Chabad put back Torah into the thoroughfare, main thoroughfare, that today the New York Times has to interview Orthodox rabbis. And if you recall, there was a Spiegel who wrote, if I have the name correctly, he's no longer alive. He was their reporter on Jewish matters. I remember him at every RCA convention falling over to get interviews with the leading Orthodox rabbis. I would say, of course, that's a direct result of Chabad, which is what the Rav is saying, putting Torah into the public thoroughfare.
Right.
And there was, it's not a Litvish. You see, with Rav Aaron Cutler, I can tell you one story which you may know, it has surfaced, but it's a very powerful story which shows the relationship between the Rav and Rav Aaron. And that, of course, is when David Weingarten calls the Rav. He was in the travel business, and they have a chance to get Jews out of communist Cuba. Castro is allowing them out, but it's Yom Kippur, and they can only get out in Yom Kippur. And the Rav tells, so David Weingarten, call me back, I think it was in an hour or two. And years later, they meet at a wedding, And and David Weingarten was over to the Rav, do you remember me? And he said, oh, yeah, you asked me that question about taking them out. So Weingarten comes up with the courage to ask the Rav, Rebbe, why did you tell me to call you back in 2 hours? And the Rav said he wanted to consult with Rav Aaron Cutler. And when Rav Aaron told him, take them out in Yom Kippur, by all means, pikuach nefesh, the Rav paskind lahalacha. Interestingly, the wind-up was they didn't have to take them out in Yom Kippur because Castro relented and they were able to arrange a flight a day or two later.
Mm-hmm.
But it shows the relationship that he didn't want to paskin such an earth-shaking question of Chilul Yom Kippur without the acquiescence of Rav, the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Aaron Cutler. So
this is after they basically had split on the whole concept of Israel and so on, right?
Well, I think the split, it's not that they split. They grew, Rav Aaron remained intimately involved with what he received in his youth from his Rebbeim, which was not, Israel was a very minor point. It was more the avoidance or the negation of general studies, of secular studies. And certainly they lived ultimately in two different worlds. That
right.
goes without saying. But the mutual admiration of Zayim Beidik, Kent Gut Lernen, that they both knew that they knew how to learn, that was there. And that's the Litvish Gestalt that was at the essence of both individuals. So I had
right.
the honor, the schut, I knew Rav Aaron Cutler as well.
Right, because you learned in Lakewood Yeshiva, right?
I spoke in learning with Rav Aaron. I write about it in my seventh book in Washington,
right.
for Washington,
right.
where I describe Rav Aaron Cutler.
Excellent book, by the way. Excellent book, by
Thank
the way.
You. Thank you. Published by the OU. So,
of course, naturally, of course.
You're at home.
What else do you think? But you know, you also, in the article, you describe a kind of a magic moment in Yud-Shvat 1980, when the Rav goes to the Fabringen, it's the 30th anniversary of
right.
the Rebbe and so on, and then with Rabbi Herschel Schacht, the father of J.J. And it's a beautiful, beautiful story how you describe it and how the whole Torah world was, you know, so enthused about it that the two of them were together.
Right.
Maybe
what
you can elaborate a little bit.
Right. What was so important here was that we all have to understand that there was a tremendous machloket between the Hasidim and Mitnagdim when the Hasidic movement began. And there was fear that the Hasidim were reforming Judaism. I don't have to tell you problems of Tfilah Shelo Bizman, davening not at the proper times,
right.
the centrality of a Rebbe where he becomes the focal figure in the sense that all of religious life centers around him to a certain degree. These were unknown concepts. And the Vilna Gaon actually signed a Cherem. There's a volume put out by Hebrew years ago with all the Haramim back and forth between the Hasidim and Bitnagdim. I believe it's by Professor Ablevsky, Zichron Levracha. It was two volumes. I have them in my library in Yerushalayim. And when the Alter Rebbe, the Baal Tanya, who was a Gadol Shebe Gadolim in learning, decided he would go to visit the Vilna Gaon to show him that they're not against halacha and it's not Reform Judaism. And he comes to Vilna, and legend has it that the Vilna Gaon, who was the greatest matmid and never was mavatel a second from learning, suddenly leaves Vilna. And the Gaon is reported to have said he didn't want to be in the same city with the polluted air of the Baal Tanya being there. Now, just think, so many years later, generations upon generations, the great, 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 great grandson of the Baal Tanya, the Lubavitcher Rebbe,
right.
and the great, 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 great grandson of the Talmud Mufak of the Vilna Gaon, Reb Chaim Volozhin, Mori Rebbe, Reb Soloveitchik, embrace in public before the entire world. In other
right.
words, it's not just the tens of thousands that were at the Fabringen, but that picture goes before the entire world.
Is there a picture? Do people have a picture of that? Do you have a picture?
A picture appears in the Rav. A picture appears.
Uh-huh.
There isn't an absolute, perfectly clear picture,
uh-huh.
which I have to say, surprisingly for Lubavitch, who have mastered all the art of modern technology, that night something was lacking. But there is a video. I thank Lubavitch. They were very kind to me. Years ago, they gave me a raw video of the entire Fabrengen, where you have the Rav and the Rebbe. I understand that was edited and came out in a better edition. And I understand as well that the picture is taken off that video. So it's not the finest quality as far as a picture, but it's right there. The Rav and the Rebbe embracing the same.
Now, do they, in the Chabad, libraries and in their publications, do they talk about the relationship at all between the Rebbe and Rav Soloveitchik?
Oh, yeah, they do. Oh, yeah, there's a book that came out. It's a four-volume work by Rabbi Wolpe and Eretz Yisrael, who is well-known, caught up in a lot of controversy because I think he is one of the leading messianists in Eretz Yisrael. But you have to leave out his personal thinking and view the book for its content and its accuracy. And he has alphabetically arranged the Lubavitcher Rebbe's relationship with Gedolei Yisrael. There are many, many pages devoted to the Soloveitchik family.
Yeah, that's good. Very interesting. I was wondering about that. When I was reading the article, I was wondering, saying, okay, we acknowledge it, but do they have it? I'm glad to hear that that's true. I want to ask you one final question. This is not necessarily about the article, but why do you think, I'm sure people have this question, and you're probably one of the best people to ask this question, why do you think after the Rebbe passes away, he's a central figure in the Lubavitch movement, and now the movement is thriving, growing, bigger than ever, and I would have thought, which I did think then, that it would be very hard for the movement to continue without a Rebbe. So the one question is, why has it been so successful, despite the fact that there's no Rebbe? And two, why do you think they never picked another Rebbe?
Yeah. These questions we have, thought about and pondered. Let me add a little insight here. The comparison, of course, has to be to Breslov. Breslov, after the first Rebbe died, there's never a successor. And yet, Breslov continues until today. Chabad thrives. And I think here you have modern technology. You can keep a Svasvat Dovavot Bekeva. You have the videos that have been turned into DVDs. The Rebbe is there before your eyes. And I don't have to tell you, in 770, I visited a year or two ago, 624, on the side of the entrance, there are Fabrengens. You go into a restaurant with a Chabadnik. I remember in New York, my students took me out to some, it was a delicatessen, a deli, if I'm not mistaken, and on either side of the room, you had the Rebbe speaking. So on one hand, the Rebbe is gone. On the other hand, it's even better than YUTorah.org, which is only recordings, and here you have a live image, a video, a CD, etc. So I think that's part of it. The other part, of course, is a tribute to the Rebbe, that these people were so committed to him that they passed on. In other words, what we're doing is we hear the shluchim speak. They speak. What we do brings nachat to the Rebbe's memory. What we do brings nachat to the Rebbe. So you see this overwhelming figure, which is, and his figure being still tangible, has resulted in, as you say, unbelievable growth since his death. Now, why they didn't pick a Rebbe, and that's a sad part of life. What people have to understand, the Rebbe was not the Rebbe in 1920. It's something you grow into. If you have the ability, you become the Rebbe. The Rev, when he came to Yeshiva in 41, the Talmidim referred to him Bezilzel. They used to call him J.B. He was not the Rav yet. It took 10, 15 years. He became the Rav. He grew into it. He now, no one of his admirers would say J.B. anymore. Right? You understand what I'm
of
saying?
It was
the Rebbe.
I understand.
When the Rebbe died, who can replace him? Mm-hmm. My feeling was you find someone in his 40s with quality, with ability, could be in his 30s, that the genes are there, and let him grow into the position. One day, he might be, if not the equal of the Rebbe, but at least in the same league. Okay?
Very
they avoided
good.
It. Now, in the Litvische Welt, we can't avoid it, because the yeshiva can't exist without a living Rosh Yeshiva.
Well, it's really amazing, but anyway, listen, I want to thank you so much. We can go on and on and on, and anyone who knows Rami Rakefet has heard him speak, and the tapes, and the thousands and thousands of shiurim that you've given, and I know personally, you know, I've enjoyed so many of them, and I want to thank you, and Yitzhak Hashem, have good health, and continue to give the learning of Torah and the words of Torah over for many, many years. Thank you for coming on the program. I really appreciate it. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Thank you. And
okay.
Regards to your family, among them my students.
I will. Thank you so much. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.